All right, Tom, once again for another edition of Bull in the Basement, joined by a guy who's been like ridiculously nice to me his entire time in Buffalo and the time that we've known each other, former Sabre Andrew Peters, who has gone on with Craig Revet to put out an amazing podcast.
Amazing.
Dude, it's awesome. I mean, you guys together are great because you aren't afraid of what you're going to say. You don't care about blowback. You just tell people how you feel when it comes to the hockey world, and your guests are terrific and tremendous. And you've played a long time and you've been around this organization a long time and you've been around hockey a long time. So you obviously have a huge network of people that you can access to do your show podcast, whatever. It's phenomenal. So give that a plug real quick and then we'll get on to my thing, which is much more important clearly.
Yeah, you want me to plug my own thing?
Yes, of course.
No, it's just After the Whistle, my buddy Mike. I've known him. I met him through actually Ruben Brown. And, he's a real estate agent here in town. And he when he found out we were leaving the show, I told him. And he's like, dude, you should start a podcast called something like After the Whistle. And I was like, oh, my God, what a great name. And then it was like the first suggestion that he gave us. And then Riv and I just went on this tear of like trying to come up with other names, and you know, we stuck with After the Whistle. But After the Whistle, you can hear it on Apple, Spotify. We have a YouTube thing going right now, although I don't know how much longer we want to keep that going. It's a lot of work what you do, man, with all the editing and stuff. And
I never edit.
Have Elliot free. You don't edit?
No.
Well, good for you. We
totally free form, dude.
That's hey man, if you can do it in one take, good for you. Yeah. Elliot Friedman, once a week, you know, one of the biggest, if not the biggest, hockey insider. We have Jeremy Roenick on once a week, and you know, he's never short of opinion. And Brian Gionta joins us once a week, and we have, you know, some other guests in between. But we've just tried to, you know, we're only 3 months in, but we're really enjoying it. So thanks for allowing me to talk about it.
And you do, how many do you do a week typically? Two, three?
Three. We do three. Yeah. We don't have anything else going on in our lives. So, you know, we do three, and JR has been great with his time, and Elliot's been great, and Gio's always available, and he loves coming on too. So we have fun with it. That's for sure.
I mean, you got a little guy. I mean, you got something going on, man.
Well, outside of that, I mean, you know, of course, yes, I have an 8-year-old son, and you know, I mean, I'm divorced, so I have him 50-50 custody, so week on, week off. So the times that I don't have him, it's, you know, a lot of downtime. But yeah, no, I mean, when I have him, I'm a sidekick to an 8-year-old, so it's a lot of fun and a lot of energy. But yeah, you know what I mean.
Both, yeah, of course. So anyway, for people that are first seeing this, and we haven't done a lot of hockey actually, which is unfortunate. And I want to get into more as, you know, football kind of rolls out and we get it more into hockey, because there's so much to talk about, especially with the Sabres. Basically, this podcast is dedicated to people who have been, you know, influential in Western New York one way or the other. Having you haven't played for the Sabres as long as you did, and still obviously living here and still obviously being part of now sort of the media world, if you will, you're one of those guys. So what we do is we get people on, and we want basically them to tell their story. It's not necessarily about what they do. It's more about them. So let's start with you. Growing up, who was your hockey idol? Who'd you want to be? What jersey did you have?
Mario Lemieux.
Yeah.
I mean, anyone that knows me knows that I am like a Mario Lemieux diehard. I probably know all of his stats, all of them. Every year by year, I had a Lemieux jersey. I tried to emulate the way he skated. You can't ever emulate a player like that with how they play. I mean, he's just one of a kind. But Mario Lemieux, man, I mean, he's unbelievable.
You're fanboying right now.
I really am. And you know what? I'll tell you, I remember the first time I ever met him. I was playing in Rochester for the Amherst. So I was 22, and I asked Don Luce, who is the director of player personnel, someone who I love, by the way, Don Luce. You should get him on your podcast sometime. He's got some great stories. But Don Luce, I think many players that came up through the Sabres would feel this way about Don Luce. I love Don Luce, and I don't throw that word around very often, but I have a real real fond respect and love for that man, and just how he treated the players. And but anyway, so I called Don Luce and I said, you know, hey, could I was living with Jason Pominville in Rochester. It was his rookie year. Palmer man, you know, and he loved Lemieux as well. So we saw that there was a gap in our schedule and they were playing Pittsburgh here in Buffalo. And I called Don Luce and I said, could we get tickets for a few guys to come down and watch the Penguins game? And he got us tickets and we all came down. And then Pete Hassan, who was the player, you know, player affairs, like, you know, PR.
Yeah.
We saw him after and we're like, hey, could we meet Lemieux? Cause we all came down to see Don Luce and Larry Carrier, let them show that we dressed the part, you know, to come to the game. You know, we all looked somewhat kind of professional cause we all want to be in the NHL someday.
Right.
So we're trying to make an impression, and it's always good to get some FaceTime with the brass. And, you know, I asked Pete, I'm like, hey, is there any chance we could meet Lemieux? Right. And we were near the exit of the building. And he comes, he's like, yeah, let me see what I could do. He comes out with Mario Lemieux and walks him up to us. And it was myself, Palmer, I think Doug Janik was there, maybe Norm Milley, and one other guy. And he came up and I was like, oh my God. Okay. Like, so he said hello. I had on this charcoal overcoat. Okay. It was from Banana Republic. Okay. And Lemieux had on like an identical coat, but I said to him, like, hey, Mario, nice coat. We have the same coat. And Palmer looks at me and he goes, his is probably about $5,000 more than more than yours. But the embarrassing part was, here I am, I'm 22, and I took my ticket out and I asked him to sign it. And I'm like, would you mind signing this? None of the other guys got his autograph. And they fucking razzed me in the locker room for so long for asking for Lemieux's autograph. And I'm like, look, this is my idol. I mean, if I'm never going to play against him one day, then I would love to just, you know, get his autograph. And I got his autograph. And then years later, I'm playing in the NHL. It's Crosby's rookie year. And he comes back to play. So I walk into the rink one night to, you know, getting ready to play Pittsburgh. And this is 05-06. And he's standing in the hallway, taping, like doing his stick, cutting his stick. He had on Crocs. Okay. He was wearing Crocs before Crocs were even a thing. Right. And I just remember I walked in, like, shit, we're not supposed to talk to the opponent. Shit. What do I do? What do I say? It's Lemieux. Like, how do you not acknowledge Mario Lemieux? Like, not only is he about to play against your team that night, but he's an owner. He's the owner of the team. So, like, I want to make an impression because who knows? Maybe Buffalo shit cans me one day and he remembers me. And I walked in and I remember, this is exactly what I remember. He looked at me and before, like, obviously I knew who he was. He says, Andrew. And I was like, hi. And I just kept walking. Right. I couldn't believe that he has to have studied players, know the league, know every single player on every team, because number one, he's building a team. And number two, he's now competing against these guys too. So, I mean, I couldn't believe it when he said my name and I was just like, oh my God. And that was my moment. I went out for warm up that night. And I just could not take my eyes off of him, like the big 66 skating around. Like, and I got scratched for that game. And I just remember all I wanted to do was just play again, just watch him from the bench or just, you know, whatever. But I didn't get that chance. But I mean, that's my Lemieux story. I have JP. You asked me about Lemieux. And I'm going to go.
Yeah.
So my rookie year, this is a cool story. My rookie year in Buffalo, we're playing as my first road trip. It was like 6 games in 13 days. And we did a West Coast swing and I think it might've ended in Colorado. And I just remember JP Dumont taking some jerseys to Jim Pizzitelli to get signed from guys on the other team. Now I didn't know you could do that. Right. So JP's like, he had Sakic and Forsberg and whatever in his bag, and he sent it over and they signed it and whatever, and he frames them and puts them in the locker room. So after the game on the plane, I went up to JP and I was like, where do you get your jerseys? And he told me, and I said, because I'd like to copy what you did, but I only want one. And he goes, well, who do you want? I said, I want Mario Lemieux. I want to get it so badly. And I think I got it. It was definitely my rookie year. And I think I can't remember if he was playing that year or not, or if he was just in town as owner. But so I'm getting getting work done on my neck one day at practice, and JP walks in. Now, because JP loved Lemieux. He loved Lemieux as well. So JP walks in with a bag, and he sees me on the training table. He goes, hey, Petey, I put a bag on the back of Pizza's door. And I was like, okay. He's like, check it out. Let me know what you think. And I went after I was getting a massage of my neck or whatever, because I probably scrapped and my neck was killing me. And I went and I grabbed the bag, and inside it was a nicely folded, still like pre-packaged, authentic 2002 red Team Canada Olympic jersey with Lemieux and 66 on the back. And I went up to it. I was like, oh my God, thank you so much. What do I owe you? And JP says, you don't owe me anything. Thanks for what you do for our team and all the fighting and how hard your job is. He goes, thanks for doing that. And he said, when he's going to be here next week, send it over to the trainer and he'll have it signed. So I got it signed. I now have it framed here, and it's something I'll give to my little guy down the road. But that was one of the coolest gestures a teammate ever made to me. And JP Dumont is one of the classiest guys you'll ever meet. So anyway, that's my Lemieux story.
Okay. So let's take this to a next level. Why not 66?
Who, for me?
Yeah.
To wear?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Josh Hosang when he first made his debut with the Islanders, he wore 66 and he just got abused for it. I mean, that number should be retired.
Yeah.
There's only one 66. Yeah. I mean, you know, just like there's 199, mm-hmm. you know, number 9 should be retired for Gordie Howe. Number 4 should be retired for Bobby Orr. I mean, you know, but 66 is just an iconic number, and you don't touch it, you know?
Yeah,
but,
fair enough. That makes sense.
So, but I never would have done that anyway, even if I could have, because it's like, it's just, to me, that would have been
sacrilegious.
Sacrilegious, yeah.
Yeah. So when did you know, at what point, how old were you, if you remember a number, how old were you when you knew you were good enough to go to the NHL and play at that level? Were you bigger than everybody, like, always?
Well, so yeah, I mean, so by the end of grade six, I had size 12 or 13 feet in grade six.
Yeah, I still don't have those.
So yeah, well, my feet haven't grown. So like, I was size 13 and I had these clumpy feet, and I was really awkward and gangly because I was such a big kid. And then by the end of grade eight, I was 6'1". By the end of grade nine, actually, by the end of grade nine, I was 6'4", and I had stopped growing. And that by that time, I'm 15 years old. And but I went to a tryout for a tier two team by fluke. I got asked to come and try out because a former agent of mine, who was not my agent in my pro career, we had a falling out. But. He was always around the OHL rink where my brother played. Now, my brother was a second overall draft pick in the OHL, and I was hanging out at all his games. Oh, I was a hockey nut, okay? And, you know, and he met me, and he's talking to me. He's like, do you play? I was like, yeah, I play hockey, you know, and I was pretty skilled. I mean, I had good hands. I was, you know, I wasn't the fastest skater, but I had good hands and, you know, good moves and things like that. And and he's like, you should come try out for this tier two team. And I'm like, oh, okay. You know, like, whatever. I'll absolutely, you know? And I went and tried out, and I obviously made an impression. I made the team as a 15-year-old in the Metro Junior A League, which is now the Ontario Provincial Junior A League. And I moved away from home to go and play. And, you know, that was when I kind of thought, you know, there's something there. I was never always the best player on my teams. I was always a very good player on my teams, but I was never one of the best players on my teams. And And, you know, that was kind of my time where I thought, you know what, I can maybe try to make a run at hockey, you know, and see where I can go. And really all I wanted to do was just get to the OHL like my brother, because the OHL, you're the shit, right?
Yeah,
you're playing in the O, you know, you got your mullet or whatever you got, you know, you got your team tracksuit. But I mean, that was really just as far as I wanted to go. And I got drafted in the second round of the OHL as a 17-year-old and had a really good rookie year, and my stock continued to rise in the monthly rankings. And I mean, I was rated as high as a first round pick, and I think it was about, so, you know, 15, 16 was around the time where I think my eyes were opened up to the fact that, hey, maybe I'm better than I thought I was. Maybe I'm not as good as my brother. 'Cause that was like the pinnacle. That was what I always tried to measure up to. And that was impossible with how good he was. So, but I think it was that time. Yeah.
So take me to, so you're at first round potential at some point, and then you eventually sign, you get drafted, you sign, whatever, you go to Rochester. And
yep.
So then your sort of, I don't know, hockey destiny is sort of created, right? So you went from being what you were to what you became, right, in the NHL. How did that play out? And how easy or difficult was it for
you're
you?
You're talking about the role, the role of being a fighter.
Yeah.
Well, it kind of started in junior, and I had a coach who was just a total asshole. no, he was. I mean, I think a lot of guys can say at some point they had a coach who was a total asshole, but he just was, and he just bullied his players, and he tried to use that tactic. And I remember he had a meeting with all the rookies. It was my first year in Oshawa, and I wasn't known for fighting at that time. I was willing to fight because I was a big guy and played physical, and, you know, with one comes the other. Right. But, mm-hmm. but for it to be a regular thing, I don't think I ever anticipated that happening. But I just remember he said, you know, Andrew, he pointed me out in the meeting. He's like, Andrew, you know, I think I was, you know, I had like 6 points in my first four games in the OHL, I know it, the early in the year, I was at the top of the team in scoring. And I remember thinking, I'm going to be a point a game guy in the OHL. This is fantastic. And he's like, you're not going to get to the NHL or be drafted in the first round by being a point a game skilled guy. You're going to do it by scoring goals and fighting, getting, you know, 200 plus penalty minutes. Well, the OHL doesn't count tens. So in my head, I'm like, holy shit, how many fives do I have to get, you know, in order to get 200 penalty minutes? And then from there, I just went on a tear. I started fighting almost every game. I mean, there were games like me and my coach, we hated each other. And there were games where I was getting one shift a night, and I would go out and I would fight. I would fight because I remember a first round pick, Jason Ward, who played in the NHL, said to me one time, he's like, anything to get on the score sheet. You just got to let the scouts hear your name over the PA system. Right. So, you know, I mean, I was so pissed. I was fighting angry, and I was beating guys up because I was so mad that I wasn't playing. And then you get a name for yourself, and then that kind of sticks with you. And then, so I went back after the draft, I went back to the junior for 2 years, and then I turned pro. And I remember my first year in Rochester, you know, I had some injuries, and, you know, it was a learning curve of what pro hockey was. I had no idea what kind of work actually went into it. Right. And what it took to be a pro. And, you know, and then my second year, I remember I was sitting out early with a shoulder injury, and, you know, we had a string of tough games coming up. We didn't have many tough guys in our lineup. And I remember our assistant coach at the time, you know, said, you know, we got Bonvy coming in here next week, Dennis Bonvy, legend. And,
yep.
You know, we got this guy and we got that guy, and, you know, Rob Ray's getting a little older, and my eyes kind of lit up, and I was like, well, that could be an opening. Right. And it just kind of took legs from there. And that year I led the American League in penalty minutes. I had 388. I think I had like 29 or 30 fights. And I mean, at the end of the year, I just remember my body was a mess, and yeah, it just went from there. And, you know, and the next thing you know, that's kind of what you get pegged as. So it was a shitty role. And I actually just spoke to John Vogel yesterday about fighting in the NHL. And I said to him, I said, you know, I wish, looking back, I would have rather not made it trying to be a real player than actually made it with the role that I made it in, you know, because there's, yeah, there's the glory and everyone loves the fighters, but there's no glory. There's no, you know what I mean? It's
yeah.
a shit job. And, you know, that's where I leave that.
And it's too probably in your role, a different level of preparation, a different level of anxiety, right? Going into every game.
100%. I mean, every night, I can't remember when the sleepless afternoon started. I mean, it had to have been like in junior, you didn't really, I think there were some guys in junior, like when you faced off against, you knew John Erskine was in town. You know what I mean? Like my last year junior, when I knew the expectations were, you know, like I fought all the heavyweights anyway, but I mean, you know, there were guys that kept you up at night. There were guys that you knew could hurt you. There were guys that you knew had this reputation for being super tough. And, you know, it was right around back then, but over the years, it got worse and worse and worse and worse because, you know, the guys that you start fighting are bigger, stronger, tougher, you know, and it, you know, it's like, and I was big and strong and tough in my own right, but it doesn't mean you like it.
Right.
You know? So yeah, you say anxiety, I can remember George LaRock coming into town and I thought he was going to be playing that night with Montreal. And I didn't sleep the whole night before. I didn't sleep the whole night, probably got an hour's sleep, came home, thought he was still in the lineup, didn't sleep, but tossed and turned my entire afternoon nap. Could barely eat my pregame meal. And because all I could think about is, you know, like, you know, it's, you're not thinking I'm going to knock this guy out, because that's not the way you're supposed to think. Like, you want to be somewhat humble. You want to believe you can win. And I believe that I could beat these guys. And I did beat a lot of them, and I lost to a lot of them too. But, you know, and then you get to the rink that night and he's not in the lineup. And now I have no energy to play the game. I have none. I have literally wasted every ounce of energy on preparing for 1 minute. 1 minute that could end your career, you know, from the right punch. Yeah. So, yeah, it's an interesting mindset that I haven't had since. I mean, I haven't had when I retired. Sorry, when I quit hockey. At, I think I was 30. I have not had that same emotion at all ever. So it's been nice psychologically getting away from it, you know?
Yeah. But, I'm sorry to bring it back to it, but
no. I mean, no, I'm not getting a twitch.
So for people that don't know, right. I think a lot of people just assume when it comes to like, all right, there's going to be a fight right on the ice. Some people think, all right, you look at the other guy, you're, all right, you want to go? Okay. Right. I mean, that happens. Right. But like, is every game, every team, every guy different? Is there a look that the both of you, hey, next shift, like how does it work game by game when you're in that role and you know there's that other guy on the other team?
I like to ask them. I never wanted to be asked, you know, because I don't think I ever wanted to know how willing the other guy was. I wanted that guy to think that I was hungry for it, you know, because, you know, that to me, that was always a psychological edge. If I ask them, you know, they're going to think I want it, because, I mean, you got to fight them anyway, probably. Right.
Right.
And I didn't have my legs under me. I could not play a shift. Like a lot of my fights were first period fights, you know, because I could not feel my feet. I couldn't think in a game knowing that, you know, you could just get whacked in the pan. The guy's like, hey, let's go. Like I needed it to happen, and not just to get it over with the play, but just to get it over with, just to get it over with, you know, I mean. And then after that, if you survive it, you just go back to playing. And then, you know, because very rarely do do guys want to fight twice?
Yeah.
It's exhausting. So, you know, very rarely do guys want to fight twice. You know, I mean, I've had a couple of two fighter games, but I haven't had, I have never had a three fighter, but I've had two fighters. I've had a two fight period once and I was dead the rest of the game. But, you know, there were also the guys that you knew wanted to play, like a guy like Sean Thornton, who was establishing himself more. Like, I never had a coach that said, just go play. Don't worry about the other guy. Occasionally, like maybe two or three times, Lindy might have said that. But he said that about LaRocque twice, which really fucked my head. And he said it one night about another guy that was super crazy tough. I can't remember who it was. And it really messed with my head. Like, just go play. Like, what do you mean? You've never said that to me before. And if you have, it's for whatever reason. But there were guys like Sean Thornton who would say, no, I got the red light from the coach. You know, I got to play. I'm going to play tonight and, you know, whatever. And I was like, oh, that's amazing. Thank you. You know what I mean? Tell your coach, thank you. But yeah, I mean, there weren't many guys that said no, that's for sure.
Who was the best? I don't want to say was the biggest dick, but like, who was the best chirper? Like, funny. Cause I know in the end, like, You're both doing a job, right? You probably end up friendly with a lot of those guys in the end, right? That you fought.
Yeah.
So who was
definitely
a
respect?
Sure. Who was the funnest guy to chirp with or at? If you're in the box, you're looking at each other, you're chirping back and forth, or maybe you're chirping on the ice.
Chirp. I don't know. Like I really didn't chirp the tough guys because I just wanted to let them sleep. You know what I mean?
Right.
But I'll tell you, my first ever exhibition game in the NHL, I went after Ty Domi. I was like, if I'm going to go, I'm going to go to the top. Okay.
Stay home. That's right.
They had another guy in the lineup that night, Doug Duhl, who I knew he'd want to fight because he's a minor league guy and I'm a minor league guy. And this is 2002. So it's the year before I ended up making the team out of camp. And I went right for Ty Domi. Right for him, right in the corner, cross-checked. I'm like, let's go, let's go. And he looked at me and he goes, make the league, kid. Right? And I'm just kind of like, oh, well, he's got a point. So then I went and I ended up fighting Doug Duhl that night. I've had some interesting conversations with guys. I got jumped by a guy in the minors who was on my brother's team. I was playing against my brother's team in the minors, Milwaukee. His name was Reed Simpson. He was a tough guy in the NHL for a long time and really tough, but he wasn't overly big. And I remember he jumped me and I had a shoulder brace on because I had popped my shoulder out like a month before that. So I was playing with a shoulder brace, so I wasn't really able to fight. And he knew I had a shoulder brace on because my brother was on his team. And I think he was asking my brother about it, like, hey, you know, what's your brother? You know, and my brother's like, yeah, I don't think he can fight. He's got a shoulder brace on. And he fucking jumps me anyway. And he's jumping. And I remember just like being in the fight and he didn't beat me up or anything. Cause I was big enough and strong enough that I could protect myself. And, it didn't turn into much. And I got in the box. I was like, you fucking coward. You know, I got a shoulder brace on. I know my brother told you. And he looks at me, he goes, I don't care if you're in a wheelchair. And I'm just like, well, okay. I guess this guy's got a few screws loose.
Oh, man.
And I'm just, you know, that's
crazy.
Yeah, it is. It is crazy. I mean, there were guys that loved it and there were guys that I know hated it. And you don't find out that they hated it. They didn't hate it until after. But, yeah. You know, I mean, and you just think, man, if I knew they hated it as much as I did, I might have had more of a psychological edge because I would have played more of the role. You know what right. I mean?
So 2022 fighting. I mean, I watch a fight in hockey in 2022 and it's they each have a hand on the other's jersey and it's basically a merry-go-round, right? I mean, it's like, I don't know. What are your thoughts? It's a whole different, I don't know.
Well, I don't want to put a timetable on this podcast, but last night, Delorier and McDermott fought and they're two of the leagues. I'd call them heavyweights.
Sure.
And, you know, they don't fight as often as the old school heavyweights, but when they do, they are the heavyweights. Ryan Reeves, another one.
Yep.
Tom Wilson. But guys, you know, string each other out. And I mean, I was running gun a lot early on in my career. I mean, I threw punches, you know, I didn't really switch hands much, but I threw, you know, fast. I know I threw hard. I've always been told I had a hard punch, but you're a little more reckless, right? And I remember it was like my third year in the NHL and, you know, you're just tired of getting stung. Like, and it, you know, you get hit and you get stung. And I started to use my reach. I started to grab a guy and I would plant my left fist right in there. I try to get just inside their shoulder and grab their shoulder pad and lock my elbow out. And I would pop my arm out right into their right shoulder. So it was, that gave me an extra, you know, it prevented them from getting a full extension on a punch. Right. And, you know, and I just, you know, and I started to just try to throw a thundering right hand because I knew I threw hard punches and I just tried to knock guys out. It's all I tried to do. I wasn't trying to trade and make it entertaining. You know, I'd lost the interest in making fights entertaining. And now I was like just trying to survive. And, you know, I think a lot of guys knew that I had a good right hand and, you know, they too tried to, you know, probably appreciated my style too, because it's easy to defend against, but if you catch someone with it, they get knocked the fuck out. Right. And, you know, so I mean, fighting styles have changed because I think, you know, it's a little more for show now than it is, you know, the really trying to fight with anger and try to hurt somebody.
So let's fast forward to the end of your career. What was it that got you to stop playing that made you quit? Was it injury? Was it lack of want? What was it? Combination of the two, or?
Well, I got bought out by New Jersey. I mean, my head wasn't in it. When I left Buffalo, I signed a 2-year deal in New Jersey, and I just lost the desire to do it. And I, you know, I really,
did that make it easier?
Make what easier? Like
leaving the game?
Yeah, leaving the game was not hard for me.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't look back and think, oh, I should have kept playing. I mean, leaving the game was not hard for me at all. You know, I got bought out by Jersey, and then I signed with Florida. I signed a 2-way deal. And the only reason why I signed the 2-way deal with Florida was because at the time their farm team was in Rochester, and I loved Rochester. It's where I started my career. And if, you know, I'd be close to Buffalo and, you know, which I had a house in Buffalo at the time, or condo, townhouse, whatever you want to call it. And, you know, I wanted to be close to Buffalo. It's close to home. You know, I probably could have signed in a couple other places, but I don't know that I really wanted to go that far anymore and do that. But anyway, so then I get sent down after a great camp with Florida. I went to camp, my best shape of my life, trained my ass off that year, 'cause I'm like, I'm going to just try to extend this as long as I can. And I got kind of wedged in a salary cap situation. Vancouver was over the cap and they traded Darcy Hordichuk, who was making $800,000 on a 1-way, to Florida for my rights. And I had already cleared waivers and was sent down to Rochester. So now I can't remember what my salary was, but it was like, you know, not 800,000, like maybe 90 or 100,000, somewhere in there was the max you could make with the waiver exemption. I can't remember all the rules, but anyway, So I'm at Macaroni Grill in Rochester with a few guys at training camp, and I get a call from my agent. He's like, "Hey, what's up?" I was like, "Not much." And he said, "You ready for the news?" I'm like, "What, am I getting called up? Am I getting called up?" He's like, "Well, you've been traded." I was like, "What?" I said, "For who?" And he said, "Darcy Hordichuk." And I said, "Am I going to Vancouver or am I going to Winnipeg?" That was a farm team. And because if I was going to Winnipeg, I was going to quit, because I had told my parents, I said to them, if I don't make the NHL this year, I'm done. I'm like, I'm not going to the minors to try to battle my way back up against these young, hungry kids. Right. And he goes, "No, they want you to go to Winnipeg." I'm like, "Fuck that." You know, like, forget that. Like, you know, like, I'm not taking my Mastiff to Winnipeg, you know, and my poor dog, you know, I'm more worried about my Mastiff than anything else. I'm like, I got this Mastiff dog. I'm like, I'm not taking Augie to fucking Winnipeg. Screw that. Like, I said, "Can you see if they can loan me?" He said, I'll see if they can keep you here in Roch as a temporary loan. I was like, perfect. So I didn't play the whole first month. I played like 2 games or whatever. And then we all had an incident at a nightclub on the road, and we all got busted with a curfew violation, and you know, Nathan Pace and I are the only Florida guys there, or the only guys that are in the minors there. He's with Florida. I'm with Winnipeg, or I'm with Vancouver, and we get sent home from the team trip along with other guys who went other ways. We were going back to Rochester, and I just remember thinking, like, all right, let's see where this goes. I'm at home, and then Vancouver's like, hey, we want you to come to Winnipeg. Come to Vancouver to work out. I'm like, I'm not coming to Vancouver to work out. I haven't done anything in like 3 weeks. I'm borderline already done here in my head. And then the coach from Winnipeg calls, and he's like, hey, you know, we're in Roch. Can we meet? And I was like, yeah, I don't know. I'm at Wegmans and in Roch buying a case of beer. I'm going grocery shopping. I'm loading up on beers because I'm like, I don't expect any of this. And I blew off that meeting. I can't remember the coach's name. I just told him, I said, I don't think I'm there mentally. I said, I just don't think I'm there mentally. And then I remember I had the talk with Steve. It was in early February. And I remember I went to my agent's office, who was also in Rochester, and I just said, I think I'm done. I just think I'm done. I think I just don't think I want to play anymore, because Vancouver wanted me to come in, like, to go and play in Winnipeg, and they had no toughness or whatever in Vancouver. I don't know what they wanted. And said, I don't think I want to do it. So I think I'm done. I think I want to retire. And he stood up, put his hand out, shook my hand, and said, congrats on an awesome career, man. I'm proud of you. I'm proud of you for being able to come to this decision. And yeah, and that's, you know, and that was that. That was the end of my career.
It was a good run.
And right? I'll tell you quickly, you want to know something? The next day, I was not ever known ever for what as a sleep-in kind of guy. I never slept well in my life. I remember the next day, then that night, didn't drink. I wasn't drunk, no Ambien, no nothing. I went to bed reasonable time, and I slept. I just remember I woke up at 11 o'clock the next morning. And I remember thinking, I've never felt so relieved in my life to know that that chapter's closed, you know? So
that's amazing, man. I mean, I know a lot of guys struggle with that. And you were at peace almost immediately, which is really remarkable. So listen, this typically with this, my podcast, it kind of goes like this, because I just have conversations with people, and they end up going really long, and we don't even get to a lot of the things that I want to talk about. So,
well, I just bumped an appointment if you want to keep me for a little bit longer, but I you know, so as I'm enjoying this, I'm enjoying chatting with you. I love when it's all about me.
All right. Well, so I'll ask you one question Sabres wise, and then your podcast covers everything Sabres anyway, 3 days a week. So it's not like people are going to get that from your podcast, right? But here's the question I'm going to ask you, because I think it's relevant. And I don't know him. You do somewhat. Usually coaches are judged on wins and losses, right? Will Don Granato, will they give him the time and the chance, do you think, to get guys in here to have a competitive, winnable, even fringe playoff team roster, including goaltenders, so that he can win and people can look back and say, wow, look at what he's done with this team? Or do you think he will just never get that chance? It will just take too long for some of these young guys to get up and develop and be good enough as a group to be playoff worthy.
I think Kevin Adams is committed to him. I think Don Granato is a good teacher. You know, the thing is, you look at this team that they have now. How many guys in this roster are going to be here in 2 years? Five. You know, you got a few guys in the minors. I mean, you got Owen Power coming in next year, probably next year. But it's going to be very hard to build this team through free agency, because right now Buffalo's not a hot market to come to. Like back when I played here in 05, 06, 06, 07, you know, guys wanted to come here because they could win here. There was a chance to win here. But right now that's not the case, and things haven't been going very well in the last little bit. And I don't know if how the Jack Eichel situation was handled, if that's going to, how that's going to be viewed by players around the league and whatnot, but it's going to be hard to attract the right kind of pieces here over the next couple of years. And that's not Don Granato's fault.
Right.
So, you know, I said this on our podcast. I said, you know, he really only needs to teach or have six or seven guys on this current roster that actually need to learn and understand what it is he's trying to teach. Like if the rest of them do, great, it'll help them. But the reality is they're not going to be here anyway. So you need your Dylan Cousins. I know Mittelstadt's been out, but you need him. Your Tage Thompson, your Alex Tuch, your Paterka, your Jack Quinn. I'm forgetting Darlene Krebs. Thank you. I know I'm forgetting a couple other guys, but I mean, you know, for the most part, that's your future right there. Samuelson is another one. So yeah, I think he'll be given time because Kevin Adams isn't stupid and he knows this thing isn't next year away. You know, I mean, could it be? Maybe, but that's a generous maybe.
Yeah.
I think it's more 2-3 years away from, you know, these guys taking a turn, getting comfortable in the NHL, making their mark, and being able to help contribute to wins. Because it's a lot to ask young players to lead your group. Yeah. I mean, it happened after Drury and Briere left. They're only two players, but, you know, Greerzy went, McKee went, Dumont went, and you leave it up to Roy, Vanek, Pominville, and they're all great players. They turned into great players, but at that point in 07, 08, it's a little too early in their career to Drew Stafford. I remember when Drury and Briere left, Larry Quinn was like, oh, we're going to be fine. This guy's going to do this, and this guy's going to do this, and this guy's going to do this. And I'm like, wow, we got an optimistic president. Maybe he's right, but he wasn't. And took a few years for the team to get back to the playoffs.
Yeah. Let me ask you very quickly. Have you seen this many injuries to goaltenders in 1 year? And additionally, before he was hurt, do you feel like UPL finally sort of hit a stride and was like now going to be more permanent NHL?
He might've been more permanent NHL by default because of the goaltending situation, but he wasn't necessarily winning a lot of games for the team. I got to go look at his record, but I mean, the injuries were always a question with him. I mean, he's had the double hip surgery, I believe, a couple years ago. I think he got hurt last year, you know, and now he's hurt again. And, you know, you hope that he can overcome it because you see the promise in his game. Like you see it, big body, moves well. You know, there's a lot of talent there, but he's just got to stay. He's got to stay healthy. And right now that's hard for him to do.
Yeah. Again, there's so much more to talk about. Obviously with the Olympics not happening, at least in terms of NHLers now, the schedule's all weird and make up COVID games. And
I know,
it's nuts, man.
I know it's been a crazy couple of years for not just the NHL, but for life.
Yeah. Yeah, you know? For sure. So one more time, plug your podcast because I have a whole lot more I want to talk to you about, but I want to dedicate that to another podcast for another time.
After the whistle, yep. Spotify, Apple. Not sure how long we'll keep going with the YouTube thing. You know, but Spotify, Apple, everywhere else you find your podcast, it's you'll like this. After the whistle on Twitter. You know, after the whistle was taken, so we went with the French version of the through the LE in there. Yeah, we're on Twitter and, we, you know, three shows a week. We have Roenick on, Elliot Friedman at the start of the week, Jeremy Roenick in the middle, and Brian Gionta normally joins us in the end. And we've, you know, who we interviewed, we had Ryan Leaf on.
I
saw a tweet of his about, he was 7 years out of prison and 9 years sober. And, you know, I can relate to that sobriety thing as you and I were talking about before. And, you know, we had him on and man, he was polarizing. And we have another one coming out here soon. I don't know when this podcast is going to air, but we have another one coming out next week with Bobby Ryan, second overall pick in the NHL. And what, you know, his dad was on the run from the FBI and they changed his name and he went into the substance abuse program for alcohol and he's now sober and you know, he opened up to us about that. And you know, that's something that, you know, is very close to me, is the sobriety thing, because I understand not only the difficulty of having the issues, but the difficulty in quitting. Right. So,
for sure.
You know, and a lot of that too, Bull, was the role in hockey. I mean, I had some unfortunate shit happen to me when I was a kid that I don't really want to dive into too much here, but, you know, those demons were buried through hockey. And then you drown them out with alcohol, you numb the pain, with alcohol. And, you know, I mean, it's okay sometimes to say, hey, you know, I'm fucked up, you know, I need some help. And, you know, first step is, getting rid of any substances that you might be using to mask that pain. And, yeah. So, I mean, that was in number 9 episode on ours, was amazing with Brent Sopel. He's the first guy that spoke about, Kyle Beach, you know, who was sexually abused by the strength coach in Chicago.
Yeah.
And, you know, Soaps went through, you know, he was alcohol, coke, all these different drugs. He was basically had an intervention and thrown into rehab. And we, you know, he was very open and candid. And I think, those two guys alone, 3 guys actually, now that we've had on, I don't want to discredit Bobby Ryan, but he was more recent. He hasn't come out yet, but Sopel was first. That's what led me to seek out Ryan Leaf. And then, you know, my brother played with Bobby Ryan, and his story is no secret. And, you know, I sought him out and had him on, because these are conversations that are sports related, but they're beyond sports.
For sure.
You know what I mean? There's a lot more. And I think the one thing I loved most about it was the responses that we got afterward, you know, and, you know, how many people are in trouble or seeking help for whatever. And a lot of these people are like me, their shit stems from childhood, whether it's sexual abuse as a child, like I went through, or whether it's abuse from parents or bullying in school or whatever the case may be. All these people have, you know, fallen victim to the substances. And, you know, it was just, it's nice to know that the people that are struggling, you hate to hear it, but the people that are struggling are willing and wanting to reach out and talk about it. And, I've responded to all of them. There's not one person I've left unread. I, you know, from our DMs in our show account to our email that we have in our show account. I just overwhelming over 100, like 3-digit numbers, triple digits. And, you know, and it, there's some, you hate to use the word comfort, but there's some comfort in that. I like, people should feel comfortable knowing that other people are suffering from the same thing, and people are excelling, you know, even though they had, because, you know, that can help them believe that there's some normalcy for them too. You know,
it is as simple sometimes as a conversation, right?
It really is. I mean, go ahead. You were going to say something.
No.
It really is. Like, you're absolutely right. You know, they say just, you know, talk about it. So there's one guy that reached out to me, and, or sorry, of one of the people of the people that reached out to me, there's one guy that sticks out. He had never told anybody that he was sexually abused. He was afraid that nobody would believe him, the person that abused him, how long it went on, all of it. And he and I talked and talked and talked. I mean, we got on the phone. We were on the phone for hours. And it was one of the most therapeutic discussions I'd ever had. And I just remember, I still keep in touch with him to this day. And I just remember thinking to myself, you know, I hope my conversation helped. Well, he calls me like 2 weeks later. And he's like, hey, man, I got to tell you something. And I was like, what's going on? I was concerned, right? I'm like, shit, like what's going on? And he says, sat down and told my wife what happened to me when I was a kid. I was like, fuck, good for you. I was like, good for you. How did that feel? He said, I've never felt better. He said, then I went and told, you know, I met with some of my friends, and, you know, I get emotional thinking about it. I have goosebumps thinking about it. And he's like, I went and told some of my closest, dearest friends, and I was hoping they would, you know, I was afraid that some of them would judge me or whatever, would think I was weird or different. And, you know, they were all just so grateful that I felt comfortable enough to share with them. And then one of them shared with him something, and it just kind of self-perpetuates, you know, and you think he helped himself, but talking to me made him feel a little more comfortable, you know, like, you know,
I was
like,
his own support group. Yeah.
I was like, don't be afraid, you know, don't be afraid. You know, one of the hardest conversations I've ever had was about that with my parents, because I swore I would never tell them. And I did just 4 years, 3 years ago. And my life has been different ever since. My relationship with my parents has been different ever since, because I feel like they actually truly know me now, know all the real depths of me. And that's, you know, there's, like I said to you, there's freedom in that. There's a lot of freedom in that. You know, like you say, it starts with a conversation, Bull, and you're absolutely right. I mean, look at this. I mean, I'm talking to you about this the same way I was talking to you at the start of the show about Mario Lemieux. It's just two very different conversations, but two conversations I'm very passionate about, because, you know, once you've been in the shit and in the depths of hell, emotionally and mentally, even though you're making money and everything's shiny, you got a nice car and, you know, whatever, and, you know, life's good, you're playing in the NHL, you know, like there's a broken soul there, you know, and I've never been more free and I've never been more happy. And, you know, my son has a sober, clear-minded father that can help him with these discussions, you know, for him to be prepared, because I'm not afraid to talk about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's phenomenal, man. And I'm glad this went to where it did. Here I am trying to wrap things up. I'm really happy it did.
Well, it did, because I remember you asked me at the start of the show, you know, are you okay talking about sobriety? And I was like, yeah. And then I started rambling and I felt guilty because, you know, here I am taking up all your time. And I know that you had a serious topic that you wanted to get to. And I, you know, and I know what that's like. I mean, I know what it's like to miss out on a conversation and then think, oh, I want to have that another time. But no, I mean, it's an important discussion, and it's the most important discussion, because mental health now is everywhere. People are actually starting to appreciate it and give it the respect that it deserves. And it's long overdue. And think about all the people that died with secrets, that, you know, went to their grave, you know, not being able to clear their conscience or just, you know, get help. You know, I know people that have committed suicide. I mean, I know them personally. And the first thing I think is, why the fuck didn't you say anything? You know, why does it have to get to that point? I was fucking suicidal long time ago. I mean, like it was, but no one knew why. You know, everyone's thinking like, oh, you know, these athletes, it's just transition. They don't know how to handle it. No, well, no, I mean, a lot of guys mask their stuff through sports or through whatever. And I see guys and people, I don't mean guys, I'm talking like just hockey players that I play with, but people in general, men, women, kids, you know, mask it with something or escape it through a different avenue.
They put on a happy face when behind it. Right.
Right. Yeah. Right. And I mean, it's like, I can tell you, I should be an actor because I acted happy for so long that I faked it. I was like, oh, you're such a happy guy. I mean, wow. I mean, man, like, I'd love to have your perspective on things and blah, blah, blah. And I'm just kind of like, if only you knew, you know what I mean? If only you knew, but you know, it's, you know, it is what it is, man. I mean, it's part of growing, and I'm glad that the conversations are being had. I'm not as vocal about it, 'cause I don't know. I don't want to sound like a preacher, but I'm just glad people know a little bit about, you know, my struggles, and I've had a lot of people reach out, and they're still reaching out. And I just opened up my email this morning, and another person went back and listened to episode 9 and listened to the Ryan Leaf thing, and they're, You know, I got a guy that says, you know, I tried quitting drinking for 2 weeks and I failed. And I know my response to him was I tried quitting drinking three times. I failed three times. You know, I mean, people view failure as that, as failure, but failure and recognizing that you failed will only make you succeed the next time. And if you fail the next time and you just keep trying, it's that old, the old adage, you know, you get knocked down, you get back up. I mean, people, society still now, you know, some people gawk at that. They laugh and it's just like, well, you're hiding something too then. And you're just not comfortable enough to admit it yet. Maybe they'll get there someday, but yeah.
Fair enough. DM Petey, obviously through after LE Whistle.
after the whistle, and our email is ATW5276. Obviously, Craig got first number right on that one. It's, you know, after the, so it'd be ATW for after the whistle, 52 for Craig's number, 76 for my number when we played hockey, and at gmail.com. And, you know, if, I mean, I don't care what the issue is, you know, happy to listen. Drugs, alcohol, sexual abuse, any kind of abuse, you know, any kind of just emotional issue, any instability that's going on, because there's an answer for it, right?
Yeah. I can't thank you enough for feeling comfortable enough with me to do what we've just done over the last half hour. That that makes me feel really good. I appreciate that.
I have a lot of respect for you. I've known you a long time, you know, from you when you were DJing out and about, and you know, you've seen me in some of my drunken moments, and we've had a lot of fun, a lot of good times, but happy to do it. Happy to have this conversation with you, Bull. I mean, you're a real guy, you know? So I always willing to have that conversation.
Yeah. Much appreciated, man. Be well, obviously. And I promise you, we'll do this again. If we want to expand on what we just talked about or talk hockey or talk anything else, let's do it. Okay.
I'd love to. I want you to explain that Northeastern shirt you got on there. Northeastern University.
Levi plays goalie there, and he's killing it.
Wow.
That's not reason. That's not the, my nephew's, okay, okay. My nephew's a freshman at Northeastern, so I was just up there. Unfortunately, there wasn't a game when I was there, dropping him off at school, unfortunately. But cool campus, cool spot. You know, Boston's a great town, obviously. We're not very fond of their sports teams, clearly. But yeah, so there it is.
Are they the Huskies?
They are.
Yeah, yeah, right. When I was with that Florida camp we talked about earlier, we played an exhibition game in Boston, and we skated at Northeastern. Beautiful. Very facility.
Cool. Older, it really is.
A true barn, a real barn.
Old school.
By the definition.
Absolutely. Yeah. Old school.
Yeah.
I am going to see Pete Hassan in 2 days, by the way. So I'll make sure I say hello to him for you.
I love Pete, man. I like, Pete. So took me to Kiss the Summer Hello after my rookie year. First celebrity I ever met outside of hockey was William Hung from he was the guest at Kiss the Summer Hello Bash, like way down at the pier years ago. And there's William Hung there taking pictures. Remember him from
American Idol? Yeah.
She bang. tell Pete I said hello. I love Pete Hassan. Great guy.
We will see you soon. Thanks again for doing this. I really appreciate
it. You got it, man. Anytime.
Right. You got it.